This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Very best bits of today's show. It is a Monday, the 25th of July, lovingly curated as ever by our producers Isa Havilio and Shruti Rajendran. Here's what we got for you today. Coming up, some cracking interviews. Property prices in Dubai are falling. Would you believe it? Yep, that is the latest research from property monitor Zanja Hinky, their boss, joins us live in the studio. Also talking Bergonomics, the Big Mac Index from The Economist. It's always closely watched, has been since 1986, but particularly now with exchange rates around the world going haywire, euro at parity with the dollar for the first time in 20 years. The regional boss of The Economist Intelligence Unit, Robert Willock, was live in the studio with us. You're going to enjoy that conversation. And finally, crossing live to Germany because of the European energy crisis. Nord Stream 1 is back up and pumping gas into Germany, but is it going to tame inflation? Let's get the thoughts of Christoph Ruhl. He's an energy expert with Columbia University. All that to come. First up, though, Brandy and I pouring through the papers and some of the top business stories today. Where we're looking at the economics of holidays. Kurt's enjoying the third and final week of his vacation at the moment. He's back on Monday. I'm off for a couple of weeks, and then Brandy Scott is off to Europe as well. But as well as packing, I don't know, various clothes and other items for your holiday, you're probably going to have to pack some feather dusters and a Dettol spray as well, because there's no staff to clean your room in Europe, Brandy.
Yeah, and you're going to have to do that in your hand luggage if that is your strategy. Side note, I've never known people be so strategic about hand luggage, because everyone I know is packing as though their normal luggage might not turn up. People are packing snacks.
Oh, because baggage, because airports are so chaotic in Europe at the moment.
Yeah, because baggage just isn't working in a lot of places. So there is some discussion about how to max your hand luggage.
And it's all to do with the lack of staff, isn't it? Lack of baggage handlers, lack of security staff, and lack of staff in hotels in Europe as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we've spoken to one of the big transport workers unions in the last month here on the Business Breakfast, who has said, go easy on the staff in airports, please. It's not their fault. We've also spoken recently to...
Oh, can we hear from him, producer Shruti, actually? That reminds me. He was really, really good. We don't have many union leaders on the Business Breakfast, so it made
it's not our sweet spot, is it?
We'll dig him out of the archives, because he made an impassioned plea saying, don't blame the guys you see at the airport. It's not their fault.
No, it's not their fault. We've also spoken to the world's head chef, if you like, Thomas Gugler, who is the head of the World Association of chefs. We spoke to him a wee while ago and he said, look, airports are one thing, but there's a very good chance that you might have to wait a little bit for your room service club sandwich as well, because so many people let go in COVID from the hospitality industry. They haven't been hired back. We have a shortage. They've found other things to do. And the FT this weekend's done a very good long piece looking at what it means for Southern Europe, where obviously Mediterranean, a lot of great holiday spots. They say that in that area there are more than 400,000 tourism vacancies that are still waiting to be filled. And they've been speaking to the tourism organisations across that belt of Europe, who have all said with different numbers the same sort of thing. This is the big problem that we face this summer. Speaking to the Greek Tourism Confederation, for example, around 20% of the 250,000 jobs, the quarter of a million jobs that they need to staff up Greece's hotels, 50,000 or so, 20% of those jobs remain vacant at the moment. Speaking to the head of tourism at Spain's big employers organisation. They say you've also got, as well as people who left the industry in COVID because they were furloughed or made redundant and found themselves other jobs, they say they've got people ageing out. So for every 100 people who retire, only 80 people are coming into hospitality. And we spoke to Thomas about this as well, didn't we? We said, how do we make this sector attractive for people choosing their career at the moment? You know, you can look at long hours, low pay, etc., and think, don't fancy that much. Italy's National Federation of Tourism and Travel Industries as well have been speaking to those at the FT, and they have said exactly the same thing. So, and so has the World Travel and Tourism Council, saying that tourism jobs in Europe in the pandemic have fallen by about 9%.
We are just going to have to pay, as tourists, more for our paella or our souvlaki or our Coca-Cola, because people have not been earning enough money in this industry. We were joking, not joking, we were thinking earlier on about what would be the hourly rate if you're working at a restaurant in Southern Europe at the moment, and this report looks at Southern Europe. What do you think the average hourly rate is for a waiter in Spain, or waitress, whatever?
Shockingly, I would have no idea.
I speculated it might be 10 euros an hour, and it might have to go up to 15 euros an hour. I'm looking at payscale.com and other websites. It is 6 euros per hour, which is 22 dirhams. And that is why people are not flocking to work in restaurants, because they can earn more elsewhere, and all power to them. But if they're, if you're going to double their salaries to 12 euros an hour, clearly the restaurant is going to have to pass that on to you and I when we sit down there. Another story I'm looking at in on CNBC recently was that in Ibiza at the moment, at one of the top nightclubs, it's now 13 euros for a Coca-Cola, which is about 47 dirhams. And that may be where we're headed, because that's how, if you own a bar, cafe, restaurant, nightclub, hotel, doesn't matter, whatever, and suddenly you've got to pay your staff 50, maybe even more percent more, how are you going to make that back? Well, you're going to make it back on a can of Coke.
And it sounds like a high-class problem, or what will my holiday cost, but it's also not, because if we look at the potential knock-on effects, and we've had a couple of people here in the business breakfast studio last week, haven't we? We've had Greg from Food People In, for example, talking about what needs to happen to fill the vacancies in this region. And if wages go up around the world, people look at where they're going to work according to where they're going to get paid, particularly in an industry that is transitory, isn't it? You get a migrant workforce. People go from A to country B in order to earn money.
And it ultimately will have to be the consumer that pays. We're going to have to pay more for our flights, because we're going to have to pay the baggage handlers and security guards more. And we're going to have to pay more when we go out to have a bite to eat, because we're going to have to pay the people in the restaurant more and more. Do any of us as consumers want that? Of course we don't.
But it is what all the reports are warning of at the moment, that the era of cheap travel might be coming to a bit of an end.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Where we are talking property this morning. Rich, do we have some walk-on music for our guest?
It's in a house, very big house in the country. Watching afternoon repeats in the 38s in the country.
Not quite sure what counts as the country here, Silicon Oasis maybe. But Dubai house prices have fallen for the first time this year, according to a new report from Property Monitor that is going to be released today. To give us a sneak peek and to put it all in context, we're very pleased to be speaking now to the COO, Jan Jahenke, joining me in the studio. Jan, good morning. It's nice to see you.
Morning, guys. Nice to see you as well.
So we've got the first drop in values this year for June, yet at the same time seems not to be an early summer slowdown, because you've also got transaction volumes rising. How do we put this in context?
Yeah, it seems odd, right? Record transaction numbers, so the strongest June we've had in the second strongest ever, ninth strongest transaction month by far. Right, so we're looking at all those prior to that, those other eight, they're from early years back 2009, 2010, 2011. Massively strong transaction month, yet prices declining. Not unexpected. The last 3 months, we've seen a slowdown in price appreciation, right? And this month, seeing it just dip into the negative. So it's not necessarily unexpected. And I actually think it's a good thing. So this is our second decline that we've had in this current market recovery. Actually, we're not even in the recovery anymore. We're now into an expansion phase. So it's the first one we've had this year. It's the second one in the 20 months of this cycle that we've had. And I expect we're going to start to see some more tapering off to the market and slowing down.
Do you want to talk us through those four cycles that roughly make up a property market?
Yes, yeah, let's do that. So if you think of a sound wave, right? So you've got a wave, nice, easy wave with the top, you've got a peak, and then you've got a valley at the bottom. So we break that down into four cycles. cycles. The easiest one to look at is that bottom of the market, the bottom of that wave. So when's the best time to buy a property? It's right at that bottom of that wave. But you never know you're there until you're past it, right? So what we see in that is the recovery phase start. When you're about, say, a quarter in, so 3 months of positive price appreciation, confidence comes back. People are like, we're past the worst of it. That's when people come back into the market. Prices have that big bump that we saw, say, 18 months ago or so. And prices start to appreciate. And then you start to see developers come in and launch more inventory into the market. And then we get this nice growth, this recovery, things keep ticking up. We might see some ebbs and flows, some ups and downs. The next phase is expansion. And that's when developers really start pushing more into the market. And then you start to see smaller developers come in, which we're starting to see now. Ultimately, this leads to, in every market, hypersupply. Right? That's when the market has too much inventory coming into it, demand starts to wane, and then we start to get into this plateau and then a downturn into the one that one likes, the recession phase. But this is natural. Every market in the world goes through this cycle. Where are we now? We're in that expansion phase and we're probably starting to get very close to the crest of that peak.
Which would bring us into hypersupply. Tell us what we have seen in June when it comes to new stock coming on.
I would say, since we've been tracking data, an unprecedented amount of stock coming in, right? So new inventory, new development launches last month, over 5,000 units, about 5,200 units, 13 billion in volume, right, in value. Now, the entire year, we've seen about 21,000 new units come on. So in 1 month, 5,000 units. That's a lot of units coming in, right? Typically, we'd probably see closer to 10 to 15,000 units being launched a year, right? So now we've got a lot of new units coming. You've got them from the big developers and some of the small ones, and some are being very strategic where they're coming on, which is what we want. We want supply to be measured. We want supply to balance where the demand is now, but also they need to be predict where it's going to be in the future, not just for their sales, but handover in 2 to 3 years' time.
Is that why the prices are coming down, because of the new supply, or is it more complicated than that?
Yes and yes. So the ready property market, and particularly the resale element of that, has had some of its best growth. And now you're starting to see that growth slow. You gave an example earlier this morning where someone was, I think it was 2.2, and then they came down to 2.1. Seeing that in other communities as well. The resale market rapidly appreciated, right? Prices have sort of topped out in a lot of these communities. Developers are very strategic in what they're launching. They're launching at price points that make it very favorable to wait a couple of years to take that unit on. So you're seeing more in that affordable side. I'll contradict myself. Last month was also probably the strongest month ever for the ultra luxury segment. So if we say on a percentile basis, probably the 97th percentile and above, stuff that's in the 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 dirhams per square foot range, that ultra luxury segment, biggest launches we've ever seen.
So what does this dip in prices mean for maybe heading towards a bit of stabilization, that elusive market maturity that we keep talking about?
Yes. We want to see this, and it's what I've been harping on about for probably the last year. Prices ran away. It was great. We had this bump. You saw 2.5% appreciation month on month. Fun, right? But we want to see that taper down to exactly what we're seeing now. To put it into contrast, the last recovery cycle ran 24 months, right? And towards the end of that, it was hitting 2-3% month on month appreciation. We're not seeing that now. We're 20 months in. We see this small and stable and month on month, it's sensible price growth. It's things where people can afford to go after it. Right? Affordability is one of the things that's really going to start to come into the market, especially in the mortgage side of the market. So one of the other things that we highlighted in the report, a big jump for mortgages, right? Mortgages were tapering down, and now we've seen about 2,300 mortgages last month. The interesting part about that, though, is we had the Fed rate increase, 75 basis points. And then we saw the week after that, mortgage transactions spike, right? They went up to probably their highest in 9 months on a weekly basis. And then the weeks following that, they've been tapering down. Today and tomorrow, there's an FOMC meeting, right? And we are going to see another rate increase. What's that going to be? My money is going to be on at least 75 basis points, more than likely a full percentage point. And that's going to have an effect on what happens in the market here.
Is it if the last one didn't?
Oh, it did, right? It had an effect. So you had this bump straight after. It was a 1 week bump, right, that drove that increase, right? And now then it's been tapering off. I don't anticipate another bump, or if it is, not as big as the one we just had. And I think you're going to see additional increases coming, potentially tapering off towards the end of the year to maybe they go down to 50 basis points, 25. But rates are going up, and it all goes back to the US inflation story.
So what is this likely to look and feel like on the ground, Jean? Not just for those looking to buy, but also those looking to sell?
So if you're looking to sell, what I think the example you gave earlier is a seller's got the right to go out and try a price point. The quicker they react to the market on that price point and lower it if they need to, the better. So if you're a seller, that would be my advice to you. If you want to test a price, test it. But if you don't get offers quickly with it, then you need to lower the price. If you're a buyer, you really have to weigh up your options, especially if you're a mortgage buyer and those monthly payments coming in. I think the last time I was on, I said lock in a fixed rate as soon as you can, 3 to 5 years. Still the same advice. Lock in the longest fixed term possible. If you're someone that's looking in the off-plan segment, now is a good time to buy. There is so much product coming in, but it's also going very fast from the big developers. Some of the big developers are launching a project, and in a day or two, inventory's gone. Right? We didn't see that for probably 5 or 6 years. Small developers taking a little longer to move that inventory.
You've been in this market for a long time. We've got about 40 seconds left with you. How long do you see this current phase lasting? What kind of timescales are we talking?
It depends on a few factors, right? The wild cards that come in. Inflation, rates, supply. One of the biggest things that I'd be watching now is supply. I think what we're going to see is over the next couple of quarters, prices to continue what they're doing now, slow and taper down, some small positives, some small negative months. I think that boom part of the market, we've passed that big boom. We're now going to go into a sense of maturity and slowdown and potentially see this positive side of the market run for another, say, 9 to 12 months.
Sian Jahenki is the COO of Property Monitor. That new report due out today, running us through the facts and figures for it, including the fact that June has seen the first drop in property values, residential property values, so far this year. Thank you very much for joining us.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Where we are talking about the economics of burgers.
McDonald's Big Mac, the big sandwich with a great big taste that everybody's talking about.
Two all beef patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun.
Two all beef patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun. Oh, got him!
You deserve a break today at McDonald's.
That is a 1974 advert for the Big Mac. The Economist Big Mac Index isn't quite that old, but not far off. In 1986, they launched it. And joining us in the studio to talk to us about how relevant it is today in this era of inflation is Robert Willock. He's the director for this region and general manager at the Economist Intelligence Unit. Morning, Robert.
Good morning, Richard.
Right then, let's take a step back and remind ourselves, what is the Economist Big Mac Index? Why was it invented and what does it do?
So the Big Mac Index, or Burgernomics as it's often called, was invented by the Economist, as you say, 36 years ago. And really it was designed to show the importance of purchasing power parity, PPP. And that's the notion that in the long run, exchange rates should move towards a rate that will equalise the prices of an identical basket of goods or services in any two countries. So I suppose, basically, in principle, the value of a currency should reflect its power to buy things. And so this index was designed not as a formal economic tool, but as a light-hearted guide to whether currencies are at their correct level.
Because things like purchasing power parity are quite dry economic subjects, but you call it a Big Mac Index and suddenly everyone lights up. So if we look at the Big Mac Index at the moment, and I've pulled it up on the Economist website at the moment, it looks like the Swiss franc is the most overvalued currency in the world at the moment, according to your index. It's 30% overvalued, followed by the country I'm going to this weekend, Norway. The krona is overvalued by 21.6%. What does that mean? Oh, and then the Swedish krona, where I'm also going next week. That's not good news, is it? So what does that mean in simple terms?
It means you've chosen two of the five countries that are overvalued compared to the dollar, which means that you will have a relatively expensive holiday. In fact, actually, there are 53 currencies against which we compare the dollar in the Big Mac Index, and only five of them at the moment are showing as overvalued. The vast majority are undervalued, and some to quite a significant degree. This means, in terms of the Big Mac Index, this means ultimately that if you buy a Big Mac in any of the countries represented in the index, let's say, for example, you buy a Big Mac in Egypt. In dollar terms, You can buy a Big Mac in Egypt for about half the price that you would buy it in the US.
Because it's $5.15 in the United States at the moment, a Big Mac.
That's right.
But in dollar terms in Egypt, a Big Mac's going to cost you about
$2.60, something like that, yeah. So, or even slightly less than that. So that would imply that the Egyptian pound is around 50% undervalued. Now, of course, you know, there are other variables at play here. It's, I mean, the nice thing about the Big Mac is that it's a completely standardized product. Wherever you are in the world, you know, I mean, you just played the jingle. I remember it myself. To all beef patties, lettuce, sauce, special cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun.
Or oh, something nailed like that. It. Well
something,
done,
well,
sir.
I think I got it slightly wrong. but I remember that. And it's the same wherever you go in the world. And I'm sure you and lots of your listeners have been to far-flung places in the world, looked at the array of food on display, particularly perhaps street food, and thought to yourself, I think it might be safer to go to McDonald's. And of course, the idea then is that because it's such a standardized product, they are made identically wherever you are in the world. It's a great product to use to measure purchasing power parity. Now, of course, there are other variables. There are things like the cost of labor. There are things like the cost of property. And those things are likely to be variable. And then it's also fair to say, I think, that in poorer countries, they often seem cheap relative to richer countries when you go there. And so perhaps the price of a burger in those countries is about what you might expect given the country's GDP per person. So to some extent, our index is adjusted for GDP, but not enormously. So it still provides, I think, an important guide to the actual purchasing power parity of the currencies in each of those countries.
I'm looking at the Gulf countries, and obviously our currencies are pegged to the US dollar. Kuwait, slightly different, but that's fine. But UAE, Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, all undervalued in terms of the Big Mac index, particularly Bahrain, where it's 18% undervalued. Here in the UAE, it's a fairly small gap. It's about 5% undervalued. But that basically means that a Big Mac in Dubai cost about 5% less than a Big Mac in New York. Am I right?
That's right. Yeah, so, I mean, we use McDonald's own prices for these things, so we are benchmarking against real live prices. And, of course, where you are pegged to the dollar, you might expect prices of commodities, staples, products and services to be equivalent. But, for example, here in Dubai, if we're saying that the dirham is 3.67 to the dollar, that doesn't mean that everything you buy in Dubai is 3.67 times more in dirhams than you would pay in dollars. There are lots of other factors involved. But
it's, if we were looking at Levi jeans or a Cadillac or a Tesla or something, we would have small fluctuations as well.
You would. And of course, there'll be differences in local tax rates, for example. So VAT here is less perhaps than you would find elsewhere. But you're right to point out that even in dollar pegged currency environments such as the GCC, there are significant variations. So, as you said, the dirham is about 5% undervalued to the dollar in the Big Mac index. Saudi rial is about 12% undervalued to the dollar. And then, of course, the nice thing about the index is you can compare any two countries. It's not just comparing against the dollar. So you would see, for example, then that the Saudi rial is slightly undervalued compared to the dirham. And the nice thing about the index is it's complete open source software. You can go in, you can have a play, you can see how the currencies fare in the countries in which you're living.
Imitation is the highest form of flattery. There's also a Starbucks latte index, is there not? There are others of these things. How do you guys at The Economist feel about that? Do you take it as a compliment, or do you kind of mumble critically under your breath?
Yeah, look, this was never invented as a serious economic tool, just something to make you know, exchange rate theory more digestible. But it has become a global standard. You know, it is included in economic textbooks. It is used.
Is it in yours, Brandy Scott? You bought an economic textbook last week, didn't you? Is it 500 pages?
It was the Big Mac Index there, chapter 5.
Oh, I'm up to about page 9. That's been a year.
But it's an important issue, actually, and the US Treasury does take this seriously. In fact, twice a year, it reports to Congress on countries that might be keeping their currencies artificially low. Artificially cheap to boost exports and steal a competitive edge. So, you know, this is something that is taken quite seriously by major economies around the world.
Last question. I'm spotting an arbitrage opportunity. I'm going to Oslo on Saturday, and the krona is about 27% overvalued against the dirham, 21% against the dollar in terms of Big Macs, 27% against the dirham. Should I just take three suitcases full of Big Macs and sell them on the streets of Oslo?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, Richard. Why don't you do that and let us know how that goes for you?
I'll give you a cut. Robert, good to see you. Thanks very much indeed for joining us this morning. That is the word from the guys behind the Economist Big Mac Index. Robert Willock is Director for the Middle East and North Africa and also the Regional General Manager at the Economist Intelligence Unit.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Where we are, as you say, travelling to Germany. Our next guest bringing in a new challenge for those joining us on Microsoft Teams, a game we could play Prove You Are Where You Say You Are, because he does look most definitely as though he is sitting in Europe this morning. Christoph Ruhl is Senior Research Scholar for the Centre of Global Energy Policy at Columbia University, but he does, as you say, join us from Freiburg in Germany, which is brilliant because gas is flowing again into Europe through Nord Stream 1. But the question is, how much of it and for how long? On Friday, after the tap was turned on, the pipes started flowing again, gas actually rose by 5%. There are concerns about how long it's going to last. Putting that in context for us is Christoph Ruhl. Christoph, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning again. Can you hear me now?
I can, and apologies for the technical kerfuffle at our end. Fortunately, those turning on the pipeline doing a little bit better than us. Tell us, how much of a relief is this to Europe, and where are the concerns?
I think it's not that much of a relief because the European Union, it is true, they expected that Russia might cut off the gas completely. I think that was always unlikely because that would mean that Russia cuts itself into its revenues for good. And so this is much more going forward, more likely now to be a roller coaster with hot and cold and hot and cold. One of the specialities, I shouldn't say of the Russians, I should say of the Putin administration, is to switch it on and off and use it as a political instrument. That's what people here expect, and I think that's roughly right. And that what requires, of course, that one makes more preparations to become more independent from these on and off switches somewhere in Moscow.
Remind us how reliant Europe is, particularly Germany, where you are, on Russian gas.
Big progress has been made. So it used to be the case that 40% of all the European Union gas consumption came from Russian pipelines. That's down now to about 16%. And it's down for two main reasons. One is that there is a number of countries, four or five of them, who have already decided to completely cut themselves off Russian imports. That's countries among them big like Denmark, mid-sized Bulgaria, small ones like Lithuania, Poland. That brought it down by 16%. And then there are the big countries, in particular Germany, who have managed to cut their inflows from Russia, not to zero yet, but down substantially. And all told altogether, this makes for a reduction, which is sizable, from 40 to 16%. And what is important, of course, is two things from the Russian perspective. These reductions, which are in place right now, are likely to be permanent. These are countries who have found alternative supplies and have created savings and other import flows. And secondly, whatever Russia loses in terms of gas exports to Europe is stranded. It cannot be sent somewhere else because the gas to Europe comes from Western Siberia. There is no pipeline going from Western to Eastern Siberia or onto Asia. The only pipeline from Western Siberian gas fields leads into Europe. So whatever Europe doesn't take anymore is gone for good. And this is a substantial part of Russian revenues. And that is also the deeper reasons why people like me believe that Russia will not cut it off completely, only once the game is over and too late, because it would be a big cut in its own revenue flows. And to the extent that it's replaced in Europe, it will not come back.
But at the moment, the concern is filling everything up in preparation for winter, isn't it? It's stockpiling. Yeah. Talk to me about the challenges that Europe faces there.
Yeah, it's quite an absurd situation. So it is funny because it used to be the corona numbers everybody had in his newspaper every day. Now you have still corona numbers for again. And next to it, in most newspapers, you have now statistics on how full the storage is for the winter. The problem here is the German government always had the goal of getting storage full to 90%. It is not looking bad right now. It is 65%, which is sort of bang the long-term average. The problem is that even 90% is enough only for about 2.5 months, and the winter is 3.5 to 4 months. So even if the storage is full, it will still need ongoing supplies throughout the winter, if it's a normal winter, from Russia. And with this on-off game, it's of course not for certain that these supplies will be forthcoming. But it looks at the moment as if alternatives could be secured. And then there is still, you know, a very, very big policy measure which could be taken, which is that if Europe really runs out of gas and the winter is very cold, one could redirect contracted liquefied natural LNG deliveries to Asia into Europe, and that would require that Asian countries like South Korea or Japan would replace them with coal. That is a major operation which would be possible only as a part of a major political deal led and brokered by the US, but it's not something which can be completely excluded, and that would be sort of the measure of last resort. But in the meantime, I am quite amazed how in opinion polls, and also when I talk to people here, people are prepared to go to quite some lengths to save gas and to not worry about the winter so much. It's not exactly that they collect firewood here on the villages, but people, up to 70%, according to opinion polls, are willing to sacrifice their home temperatures in order to sort of wean themselves off this Russian pressure.
What does all of that look and feel like at the moment, Christoph? Because we've still got, even though gas prices came down on Friday, they're still 8-9 times higher than they were before the invasion. What are you seeing on a daily basis from not just households, but businesses and manufacturing as well?
We're seeing a big reduction in gas. So month over last year, it's about down 16%. If one takes out the temperature differences, it's still net decline of about 10%. So people starting to save, that's number one. We're seeing a debate on to what an extent and how the government should compensate households and businesses for this. We see, and this is very much a hodgepodge enterprise still at the moment, not much is consistently happening there. We're seeing attempts at saving. They are very important. For example, there's a scheme now being developed. When businesses are able to save gas, then they can auction it off, making some money out of these savings. That is going to accelerate it greatly. In general, the big emergency plans in Germany and in the EU, they prioritize households. So households are the least ones to be cut off, and businesses are the first ones to be cut off. That's a bit dangerous. And just to remind everyone what this gas is actually used for, the biggest chunk is for space heating, and that's usually houses like this one, household apartments which are heated by gas. There's no alternative for that. So there needs to be gas replacement, because the most people don't have a coal oven or an open fireplace. The second one is power generation, electricity generation. That is the one where gas can be replaced and substituted for by coal, by nuclear, by other things. And the third one is industrial use, direct industrial use as a feedstock, for example, for the chemical industry, the third biggest industry in Germany. That's where the key worry is.
We're going to have to leave it there. Unfortunately, out of time, we are speaking to Christoph Ruhl, Senior Research Scholar for the Centre of Global Energy Policy at Columbia.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.